Okay. Now I have the honor. The honor. But he's already on the stage. Okay. I was going to bring in a surprise guest, but he's already up here. I'm going to introduce him like this, that there is no way to introduce Ralph Nader, because he has been a consumer advocate without peers. He has been a compassionate person who has sacrificed at our expense all his life. He is a man who needs to be honored and needs to be listened to, every word he says. And I just want to say, I am so happy that I could be here today and that I know you, Ralph Nader.
Thank you, Donna. One thing you don't know about Donna is that she's a certified public accountant. And one of the things we want her to do is unleash her on the Pentagon. Because the General Accounting Office has declared repeatedly the Pentagon budget is unauditable. The Pentagon budget is one half of the entire U.S. operating expenditure budget. Not counting Social Security or social insurance. 50 cents out of every dollar you send to Washington to run the U.S. government is unauditable. And it never is raised by the two parties. The two parties never challenge the military budget, except to say it should be bigger. We have enough weapons to make the rubble bounce and destroy the world 300 times, but it's not enough. It's not enough. So thank you very much, Donna, because you've touched on a lot of issues, which saves me time, and I can go to another level. And I want to thank Sally Soriano, too. Where's Sally? Yeah, thank you. And I like the way that some of you stood up and talked about what you were doing. That's good. I haven't seen that around the country. I keep thinking that the Seattle gatherings like this must have something to do with the old days with the Longshoremen's Union. Maybe I'm wrong. But I just saw a little bumper, Teamsters for Kerry, and the local Teamsters came out for Nader LaDuc in 2000. So I want to start with the issue of self-respect. I want to start with what's happening to liberals, what's happening to the liberal intelligentsia, because what's happened to them and how they are about to behave on November 2nd has no end logic to it. If they are anti-war, they are prepared to support a pro-war candidate. John Kerry clearly eliminated all ambiguity in the first debate and out-hawked George W. Bush to the delight of William Sapphire, the right-wing columnist for the New York Times, who in his glee invited John Kerry to the ranks of the neocons. A vote for Kerry is now a vote for war. And Kerry was very specific. That mention of Fallujah means that if he's elected, they're moving in on those very densely populated cities and to take them over. Fallujah has about 600,000-700,000 people. And that means slaughter. That means massive civilian death. There was just a strike by the U.S. that killed 9 or 13 people in a wedding party. Oops, sorry, didn't intend to do that. You know, when you have weaponry that kills from a distance, you can kill all kinds of civilians and say, whoops, didn't mean to do that. Collateral damage. A vote for Kerry is a vote for war. Now, how does that square with some of the finest liberal writers, authors, and activists who supported us in 2000 and who issued a statement 2 weeks ago? The following statement: they urge voters in the close states to vote for John Kerry, even though, quote, we strongly disagree with Kerry on the war and other issues, end quote. There are two other gaps in that statement. One, they didn't come around and say, But in the safe states, of which there are 32 of them, vote for Nader Kamejo. They didn't even have the courtesy, decency, moxie, call it what you will, to say that. They kept silent. And the second is much more egregious. They made no demands on Kerry whatsoever. Now, this is why Kerry can become a hawk, because he knows he's got the liberal votes in his pocket, because the liberal votes operating mantra this fall is the following. Anybody but Bush, leave Kerry alone, make no demands on him. So he's free to be pulled into the grip further of the corporate supremacists. He's free to engage in protective imitation with that giant corporation in the White House disguised as a human being called George W. Bush, who freelances as a messianic militarist. And this is what you'll see if you carefully watch the debates. Because he doesn't have to worry about the liberals who are against the Patriot Act, because he doesn't have to even worry about a majority of the Muslim Americans and Arab Americans, if our reading is right, who are very much against the Patriot Act, and who have been profiled and subjected to dragnet enforcement and had their rights denied in the thousands in terms of due process and standards of probable cause, being arrested without charges, being imprisoned without lawyers, having suspected material witnesses imprisoned without their names being released. And they say, anybody but Bush, leave Kerry alone, do not make any demands on him. He's on the debates. He's standing tall. You know, that counts on the debates. You've got a swagger like a president, you know. Visuals are important. Never mind what's inside the brain. Never mind what's inside the gut. Huh? So Bush, who's used to taunting Kerry, he taunted him. Remember a few weeks ago, he said, if you knew then what you know now about Iraq, namely that he had lied about Saddam's ties with al-Qaeda, Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, this tottering dictator presiding over a dilapidated army that wasn't willing to fight for him is a menace to Turkey, Israel, and Iran. They'd obliterated him with one false move. He was a menace to his own people. And, of course, who entrenched him in 1979? The British and the U.S. Who gave him the weapons of mass destruction under Department of Commerce license under Reagan and Bush 1? Materials for chemical and biological warfare, thoroughly documented. It was the U.S. government and U.S. corporations trying to make a buck. Who wanted Saddam to slaughter suspected communists on our behalf so he was our brutal dictator? The U.S. government under both parties. Who wanted Saddam to go against the Ayatollah regime in Iran and was encouraged to do so with arms, credits, and satellite surveillance data, as well as wrong intelligence? It was both parties. So watch Bush taunting. He starts out, and John Kerry is in the Grand Canyon when the reporters say, President Bush said, what would you do now? Would you have done then if you'd known what you know now? And he says, he would have done the same thing. Only he would have done it better. You see, he would have really taken out Fallujah and Sadr City, couple weekends there. Only 2.3 million people exposed. Just think of the terrifying fright of people in those areas, in those congested slums and alleyways, and they see helicopter gunships and tanks and APCs and fighter planes. We never see it from the other side, unless that is you don't watch US TV. US TV shows the missiles taking off, Al Jazeera shows them landing. which is Which is why the U.S. is in the process, through its puppet regime, shutting down Al Jazeera. They shut down the office, and now they're harassing them every turn because they don't want the world to see what is going to be done to Fallujah and other places. That's how bad it is. A Vietnam veteran not learning the lessons of the Vietnam War, a Vietnam veteran who comes home to oppose the Vietnam War as an endless quagmire with no terminal logic or rationality or justice to it, is now saying he's going to even be more aggressive in Iraq. Where did he leave his courage? In Vietnam, supposedly. Strange definition of courage we have. Watch the taunter, the commander-in-chief. He says to Kerry, Patriot Act is essential in our war against terrorism, and I want it renewed and strengthened. Kerry, what do you say, Senator Kerry? I favored the Patriot Act. I voted for it. I support it, but not the way John Ashcroft has enforced it. Hello. The Patriot Act gives the tools for a scoundrel like John Ashcroft to apply it in a way that is slowly being overturned in the courts as a massive violation of civil liberties. No law in American history, not the sedition laws, nothing can compare with this one in its scope, its penetration, its use of technology to invade privacies, to search homes and businesses without notifying the owners. That's pretty un-American historically. To go in under flimsy probable cause, such as, ooh, there may be something to do with terrorists, the latest substitute for the word communist. Ooh, and they get it. And they get it there. Into your medical records, into your financial records, into your library records, into your credit card records. And he's still for it. So take that one off the table. The Iraq War is off the table of Bush and Kerry. This is off the table. But what else? Well, Bush feels confident enough to taunt Kerry on the second debate with his policies attacking one of the three major pillars of our democracy, civil rights, civil liberties being two, and civil justice, the unfettered right to have our day in court against corporations and doctors and hospitals who negligently or otherwise kill, injure, or produce diseases or damage or take our property. And he taunts Kerry. He says, there is too much litigation. It's frivolous litigation. It's wrecking the health care cost curve. And he taunts him. And what does John Kerry say? Instead of saying, Mr. President, you're talking about medical malpractice as if it's a financial crisis. Well, it's a death and injury crisis. It's 80,000 dead Americans a year. It's hundreds of thousands of injured Americans a year, according to the Harvard School of Public Health. And you not only have never said a word about trying to reduce the preventable violence from medical malpractice in 4 years, you want to keep out the victims and their next of kin from having their full day in court before judges and juries, the only people who see, hear, and evaluate the evidence, and you want to tie their hands by pack-greased legislators financed by the hospitals and the medical lobby that doesn't police its own bad doctors, to tie the hands, remote control of these judges. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. Our founding fathers, our patriots 200 years ago, shed blood to preserve their right of trial by jury. It was number two in their protest against King George III after no taxation without representation. And you, obeying your corporate paymasters, are going to take these rights away from the American people at their peak point of wound and defensiveness and greed? I'm not going to let you to do that. And I'm going to go all over the country and make sure you never have another day as president after January 20. What if he said something like that? Huh? Instead, he and Edwards He said, well, I'm for tort reform. Imagine using the word reform to take away people's rights. I mean, would anybody allow politicians to say, I'm for civil rights reform, which means taking rights away, right? So he uses the word. Then he said, then Bush goes in for the move. You could have voted for that bill that had caps in the Senate. And Kerry said, I'm for punitive caps. I mean, it was sensationally degrading to see someone who is a lawyer, who is a prosecuting attorney, John Kerry, grovel like that. And then to hear Edwards, you know, that smiling doll, to when he was challenged by Cheney, who taunted him. Imagine what's at stake here. We're talking about millions of people who are injured, defrauded, or lose their lives, being told by the Republican Party that they're not going to be able to get full compensation, their full day in court. And the Democrats won't stand up to them in front of 65 million people. Here's Edwards. Well, I was very proud of representing 5-year-old Valerie against her injuries, and I'll do it again, and so will John Kerry. But there are too many lawsuits, and there are frivolous lawsuits, and I would propose a way to pre-select these lawsuits outside the courtroom. What? There are too many lawsuits? There are frivolous lawsuits. It's as if the judges do not control the courtroom. It's as if the judges are not 80% of them former business lawyers. They don't read Karl Marx on their lunch break. It's as if the juries will give you $1 million for a cut finger. The juries are pretty tight-fisted. They turn down a lot of cases. You know why? Because only one of them has to be convinced against the plaintiff, and it's over. That's all the doctors and the corporations have to do, convince one of them. In states that require unanimous jury verdicts, think of the burden on the wounded person, the injured person. And then, I'm going to show you what propaganda is like by your own standard right now. Too many lawsuits? There were more civil lawsuits per capita in 1840, in 1880, than there are today. That data has been compiled by Professors Rogers and Galanter at the University of Wisconsin Law School, for anybody who's interested. Too many lawsuits? The Harvard School of Public Health studied medical malpractice litigation a few years ago, and so the problem is not too many lawsuits, the problem is too few lawsuits. Not even 10% of people who are victims of medical incompetence, indifference, neglect, or worse, even file a claim. Now watch this. This is clearly an abnormally active audience. This is an audience that doesn't take guff when people push them around. Right? Okay? Now watch this. A flood of litigation. Americans are litigious society. They actually file less than people in Australia and Belgium and so on. Now I'm going to ask you a question. I don't know anybody here, but I do know that you are far more contentious than most people in Seattle. Otherwise, why would you be here, right? Okay? Now, I'm going to ask you, how many of you, now, apart from divorce lawsuits, how many of you have ever filed a lawsuit in your life? Let me see the hands. Now, look around you. What would you say? What percent is that? Right. Flood of litigation? I said in your life. Now, let's make it even easier. How many of you or your family has ever filed a lawsuit other than a divorce suit? See, does that look like a flood of litigation? Do you see what the big lie does of the Republicans and their corporatists and the tortfeasors lobby? And the Democrats do not defend. That's the problem. We cannot rely on the Democratic Party to defend our country against the worst Republicans who ever slithered or slimed into public office. For 10 years, For 10 years, the Democrats have been losing at the local, state, national level. They even lost an election they won in 2000. They even lost the congressional elections of 2002 because they took the hottest issue in the mass media that was vulnerable to the Republicans off the table. Corporate crime wave, Enron, WorldCom, all over the mass media. 401ks going down the tubes, pensions depleted, jobs lost as these crooked executives jumped ship and collapsed the corporations under them. Instead, they didn't mention it because they're dialing for the same corporate dollars. You don't bite the hand that feeds you. And then what'd they do? They anointed Bush by not stopping the war resolution, which is an unconstitutional assignment of Article 1, Section 8, to declare war to the president. Our founding fathers only, they were adamant, only the Congress can declare war. So they anoint him in October as a wartime president. And of course, you can never criticize a wartime president, right? And he goes around beating up on their own candidates, like Senator Max Cleland and running for re-election, left three limbs in Vietnam, and there is no response. Because he's a wartime president. He's rising in the polls. What is the definition of decadence in its superlative form that can describe these sniveling political cowards who then turn around and say to people like you, you have no choice other than to stay home or vote for the least worst of the two parties? Because when you say, when you go through all these issues with the Democrats and you got them nailed on the evidence, boom, 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 their final resort is, do you know how bad the Republicans are? Boy, that's a rosy scenario for the future of American politics. Huh? The Democrats have not been given their due recognition for their decadence. I've been to the inner cities in this country where life is miserable by the hour. It's not only that it's poor. It's not only they don't get municipal services they deserve, police and fire, the way wealthier areas of the city get. It's not only that landlords don't have to obey the law for so many of these crumbling tenements with lead-based paint poisoning 200,000 kids a year. It's that the prosecutors don't pay attention to payday loans, 400-500% interest, no usury levels, rent-to-own rackets, predatory lending, redlining, the lack of credit unions, the lack of even the capacity to have banks that will open accounts. They have to go to these check-cashing stores and lose 5% just to cash a check. Now, who has dominated these cities for years and years and years and years? It's a Democratic Party. They say to African Americans, Latinos, you got nowhere to go because the Republicans are worse. Latinos, 50% without health insurance. African Americans, 40% without health insurance. Living in situations that the third world can be compared with. Hovels. Homeless, freeze in the winter, come close to dying in the summer. Hunger, 13 million kids go to bed hungry every night. Poverty, the official definition of poverty by Department of Labor is four-member family making less than $18,900 a year gross before payroll deduction. That's 37 million Americans there. But I think I have a better definition of poverty. You are poor if you have a family of four and you make under $40,000 a year with up for income taxes and payroll deduction to meet the necessities of life. I was recently at a school, a fifth grade elementary school in Chicago, and it's not an idiosyncratic school. There are thousands of schools like this. And I was drawn to the fifth grade class because the teacher earlier when I visited Chicago gave me materials about a project that the class undertook under the teacher's supervision, which is taking the entire day. That's all they do is the project. and approval of the principle. And I wrote a column on it and went around the world, and they got 400 or 500 emails. Here's the project. Teacher walks in December, says, "It's not working, children. You're not learning. What do you want to do for a project?" Unanimously, these 16 African-American kids, age 10 to 12, from the worst drug-infested drive-by shooting area in Chicago, said, we want to document the crumbling of our school, which is unfit to learn in, and demand that a new school be built nearby where a couple acres were reserved 6 years ago by the city, and nothing has happened. So I visit them, and there they are sitting. Where are they sitting? In the entry to the school. Why? There's no auditorium. And they documented with videos and pie charts and, you know, attendance shot up to 97%. There was no unruliness. No cafeteria, they eat in the corridor. No gym, they got to go down two busy streets to some rented gymnasium to play or do physical education. The school classrooms are so cold in the winter because it breaks down the heating system, they have to wear their overcoats and mitts. One of the students said, "It's hard to write with mittens." And then there's the washrooms. Now, to me, the washrooms in city schools is the ultimate canary bird of our abdication as elders. There are millions of children who hold it until after school because they're terrified of going to the washroom, being pushed around, and the plumbing is often broken. There are no towels, no soaps, no stalls, vermin all over the place, puddles of water on the floor. That's what they described with their pictures, these fifth graders. And they started getting press, public radio, Chicago Tribune. I guess it reached City Hall. They were writing City Hall. They were writing Washington. They were composing ways to get their fifth graders in the suburbs behind them. They learned all the course material through this prism of this project and what it costs to build a new school, et cetera, and who's going to pay for it. These are fifth graders. They even did a DVD. And I said to the teacher, "How are they passing their exams? This takes up the whole day, every day." She said, "No problem. They learn reading, writing, arithmetic by integrating this composite of the society around them." Imagine leave no child behind, high frequent, stupid, multiple choice, standardized test, forcing the teacher to teach to the test. Wreckage, wreckage, wreckage. And John Kerry said he voted for it, and he believes in it. It just hasn't been, the wreckage hasn't been funded adequately enough by Bush. So the news is, when I'm sitting there talking with the students, the city announced they're going to demolish the school. The students did their job too well. They're going to reassign the kids, and they're not going to build a new school. So I say to the children, "What'd you accomplish? 6 months, publicity, documentation. What'd you accomplish?" I was pushing them a bit. And you know how irrepressible kids are at that age? I mean, give me 10-year-olds in place of the White House press corps any day of the year. Okay? So I say, this to me was one of the most poignant moments of the campaign. So I don't want you to misunderstand it with a potential different kind of reaction. I said, "What did you achieve?" And a little girl stands up like this. "We now have soap." Shame on us. Shame on us. All of us. Millions of kids like this. Having their imagination, their idealism, their curiosity, their hope for their future, and even their hope for the world as they come to understand it. This tormented world of ours, where 3 billion people are trying to make it on $2 or $1 a day, racked with disease, poverty, and brutality around them. This is the way we're treating these children. And every politician says he or she is for education. Oh, education, education. Hypocrites, immobilized politicians in their sinecure, receiving their nice salaries by government checks that never bounce. I blushed with shame. I could hardly respond to that little girl. I looked out the window, and there in the distance were the great skyscrapers of Chicago, whose motto is "The City That Works." And in those skyscrapers are executives making $3, $4, $5 million a year. And in that building is the underassessment techniques, where they don't have to pay their full share of property taxes that would build these schools, another national problem. And I say, when I see that, when I see people in Walmart, single moms, working for $7 an hour, not counting what it costs to tootle along in a secondhand car to get there, and the executives are making $7,000 an hour, that's the average in 2002 of the CEOs of the top 300, 400 corporations. And I see these people, these so-called liberals in the Nation magazine, the progressive, yeah, anybody but Bush. Well, I just wrote an article for the Washington Post yesterday. You can get it off the web. It's five responsibilities of pro-liberal, pro-Kerry liberals. And one of them is to make demands on them. Not give them a free ride, because if you give them a free ride, you're not pulling them in your direction. Environmental groups, listen. Poverty, anti-poverty groups, labor groups, civil rights groups, consumer groups. If you don't pull them in your direction to adopt an agenda, presumably, which would get them more votes, unless you're ashamed of what you're advocating for the American people, if you don't pull them in your direction, where's he going to be pulled? The corporations are not squeamish. They say to people like Kerry, you toe the line, or we're going to go after you even more. And they're pulling him 24 hours a day. And he's being pulled because he's paying no penalty in the liberal wing. He knows he's got them. Lock, stock, and barrel, no matter what he does. War in Iraq, no change in the military budget, no change in hundreds of billions of middle-class tax dollars going to corporate subsidies, handouts, giveaways. No real change in the United States government. He knows that no matter what he does, he is not going to be as bad as George W. Bush. Therefore, he's got the liberal vote. So the liberals are creating their own nightmare in their cowardliness. They are demonstrating that they have no breaking point. Anyone in politics who fancies themselves as voters, who has no breaking point, has a ring in his or her nose for the duration, and is going to be drawn by the least worst party into the pits along with the country. You have to have a breaking point and say to the politician you have chosen as the least worst, this far and no further. Now let me rub it in a bit, and quickly for the liberals. Let me rub it in. I want to ask you, we have 30 major issues of great gravity that we have been advancing in Washington for all these years. There used to be a time we could really get things done. Safer cars, the Environmental Protection Act, OSHA, saving lives in the workplace, and Freedom of Information Act, and so on. No more. Washington is closed down. Do you understand that, liberals? Washington is closed down. All those groups you're supporting with $25 contributions, all they're doing is valiantly trying to work harder and harder for less and less. But they can't tell you that that Washington, D.C. is corporate-occupied territory. Every department, every agency is controlled by these corporations. I know. I've been studying them for years. We interact with them. They have their executives in the Treasury Department, Defense Department, Interior Department, Agriculture Department. They're surrounding them by 30,000 full-time lobbyists and thousands of political action committee. And the same on Capitol Hill, which we call Wuthering Heights these days. So, here's what we have to say. Is there any time, 2008, 2012, 2016, that you are going to abandon your least worst strategy? If you can't point to a breaking point, it's over. Period. If you cannot support candidates who, by your own admission, have worked and worked like Nader Kamejo, and fought and have resisted all kinds of temptations, unlike Oscar Wilde, who can resist everything but temptation, he said. If you can't support them, who else is going to come and do this in the future? If they don't get any support from the people with whom they are in policy communion, who's going to run for office? Who's going to go through the sweat? Who's going to get down and beg people for money? The same people who will spend $100 on a meal for two without thinking and have difficulty writing a check for $50 to a candidacy that has fought for what they believe in for 40 years. Who's going to do this again? And what is the credibility going to be of the anti-war movement when they vote for a pro-war candidate after the election? What's their credibility? What are they going to say? What are they going to say when Kerry intensifies the war? Because he's going for victory, unlike George W. Bush's mismanagement. What are they going to say to themselves? You know what they say? They've already told me. After Kerry gets elected, the demonstrations begin. And we just hear notices there are going to be anti-war demonstrations after November 2. After they lose any leverage over the guy. If he wins, because Bush is self-destructing incrementally. So it comes down to us, and it comes down to a few people like you. It comes down to that hardcore of voters whose ancestors were against slavery and never said to the abolitionist party, "We're going for the least worst position on slavery between the Democrats and the Whigs." Would these sniveling liberals now, pardon the word, would they ever have advised people in the 19th century to vote for Whigs or Democrats instead of the abolition party that pioneered courageously what was an unbelievable taboo, going up against the cotton plantations and so forth? Would they have said to the people who supported the women's suffrage party, "Hey, you know, choose between the Republicans and the Democrats on this issue. Don't go for the women's suffrage party. It's because a few voters supported small parties that never won a national election, but pioneered courageously the future course of our country in such major areas that we got these social justice triumphs much earlier than we would have otherwise." What is their successor? Anybody with Bush, leave Kerry alone, make no demands on Kerry. What would the ghosts of our ancestors, who put sometimes everything on the line to support the Labor Party, that pushed for trade union rights for brutalized workers in dungeon factories beset by detective goons, who went on strike when there was no other job, no unemployment compensation, no welfare, they put it on the line. And the Labor Party stood for them. Would they say to the voters who were considering supporting the Labor Party, "Nah, I mean, it's quite obvious. Vote for the Democrats. They're not as bad as McKinley." It's often said civic motivation proceeds from many sources, and so does political motivation. Those sources come from looking at our past and our courageous forebears at their finest. They didn't go for the least worst. They didn't say, "Well, let's abolish slavery only for people under 20. They didn't say, "Well, let's give women the right to vote. But, you know, you can't trust them. They're so emotional. Just give them the right to vote if they're over 45. Labor didn't say, "Well, don't give certain workers trade union rights." What's happening to us? Do we understand what's happening to us? These corporations are laughing at us. They're using billions of our dollars for free drug research and development by the NIH that gives them the drug like Taxol and AZT free. And then they turn around and charge a woman with ovarian cancer, Bristol Myers does, $14,000 for 6 treatments for a drug they never spent a cent developing. Your tax dollars, National Cancer Institute developed it and human clinically tested it. They're laughing at us. Credit cards, bank charges, surcharges, late payment charges, wearing out the rug charges. Tens of billions of dollars, banks, insurance companies, credit cards, and they're daring you to do something about it because they control your money and they can debit you. And if you try to complain, they can damage your credit rating. They're laughing at us. We own the public lands and all the gold and molybdenum and silver in the West, public lands in the West. And the Mining Act of 1872, enacted by the mining industry, unamended until now, requires the Department of Interior to give away all this gold of ours, all this molybdenum. If any foreign or domestic company discovers it on public land with their geologists, they can get a $9 billion gold mine, our gold, by paying $5 an acre over the mine. $30,000 got a Canadian company, $9 billion of our gold on public land in Nevada. That's the way it operates. They're laughing at us. Where's our self-respect? Where's our expectation level? The greatest controlling process in the history of the world is to lower people's expectation levels. Then they become their own enforcers. And that's what's happened to the liberals in this country, who have anybody but Bush, leave Kerry alone, don't make any demands. Well, it's time for us to turn on them and say, you've got the responsibility to make demands on the agenda of progressive politics. You've got the responsibility to stop the Democrats from colluding with the Republicans in dividing up our country through redistricting that leaves almost all the voters with just one party. They don't even have a fiction of two parties in 95% of the House of Representatives district. And just to the other two sources of motivation, our own observance of how the mass media is shaming us. Every item on the Nader-Kameho agenda, with one exception, how to strengthen the facilities of democracy for labor, consumers, small taxpayers, and so on. Every item, whether it's living wage, poverty, civil liberties abuses, the war in Iraq, the corporate crime wave, the corporate welfare binge, environmental degradation, criminal injustice system, has been documented again and again and again by the mass business media, commercial media. But it's not moving into the political system, which has been turned into a subsidiary of big business. Even when the mass media exposes, the political system is totally powerless and shorn of any will and backbone by organized citizenry to take up these disgraces and change them, replace them, put the country in a better direction. That's the second source of motivation. And the third, perhaps, is the most painful of all. If we don't turn it around, what are we going to say to our grandchildren and great-grandchildren when at the tender age of 9, they're sitting on grandma and grandpa's knee and they've just discovered that the world is in terrible shape? And in their searching gaze, they say, Grandma, Grandpa, where were you? What were you doing when the world was falling apart? What are we going to say to them? What are we going to say to them? Give them a chocolate bar? What are we going to say? Well, child, truth to say, we spent a lot of time watching reruns of Cheers. Do you know how many bird watchers there are in this country? I'm told 15 million, with about 3 million serious. Gloves, binoculars, diaries, early morning entry into marshes. It's a wonderful hobby while it lasts. Well, we don't have 3,000 Congress watchers in the entire country. Congress has 535 men and women. No one's going to tell me or Peter Kameho that 2 or 3 million aroused citizens who only settle for the best cannot control 535 people in Congress in the general interest of the American people. No one's going to tell me that the people cannot replace 1,500 corporations who control a majority of 535 members of Congress for their destructive agenda. Corporations have no allegiance to our country other than to abandon it or control it as they see fit. Corporations who are worsening or are indifferent to the major problems of the world, whether it's diseases they don't want to do work on because they're not profitable enough as drug companies, whether it's cancer they want to expand by spreading tobacco addiction through their clever advertisement to the young of the third world, whether it's arms control that they fuel and expand with billions of dollars of our money, subsidizing Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, to sell deadly weapons to dictatorships and other customers around the world, with a government in Washington that will not sign the Landmines Treaty or the Small Arms Treaty or a Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Corporations that love to deal with dictators because it's solid management of potential rebellious populations and cut deals for franchises and mining concessions. Corporations have to be subordinated. They can never be given the constitutional rights of real human beings. They are artificial entities. The sovereignty of the people must replace the power of corporations. I won. I might add, I never thought I'd see the day when the major business magazine of America, Business Week, whose profit rests entirely on corporate advertisements in its pages, would feature a cover 4 years ago entitled "Too Much Corporate Power" and answer it, "Yes, yes, yes," in seven detailed pages. Too much corporate power over government, over consumers, over taxpayers, over the environment. And then write an editorial saying, quote, corporations should get out of politics, end quote, because they're not human beings, they don't vote, they have no place in our political system whatsoever. I never thought I'd see the day when Business Week magazine would have, by orders of magnitude, more courage than the Republican Democratic Party, who are supposed to represent us. I've campaigned now in all 50 states, the only candidate to do so. You run for president, you don't choose favorites. Campaign from Hawaii to Maine and from Alaska to Florida. We have met lots of good people, lots of energetic people, but not enough. We've met more demoralized people, people with dashed expectations, people who shrug their shoulders at the coming election with a kind of resignation. We've met people who have thought out why they shouldn't vote. Mistake, in my judgment. We've met people who just turned 18 and are eager to vote, although most of them will not vote. But you know what we're looking for in any political movement? We're looking for the stalwarts who break their routine and give of their time, talent, and donations. In other words, they commit to nourishing a growing political movement long beyond November 2 with the kind of commitment that is 1/20th of the commitment they make in their ordinary lives. If civic engagement is considered difficult, what is rearing children? What is dealing with a sick parent? What is dealing with bills that can't be paid? And so I want to introduce to you, from down Portland, Oregon, a great public interest lawyer. Among other things, he and two others in a 15-year struggle shut down the Trojan nuclear plant, with referendums, lawsuits, demonstrations. It's not easy for a lawyer to be handcuffed in a civil disobedience demonstration against that monstrosity. It's the only nuclear plant to be shut down by civic action. The one in Sacramento had the support of the public utility district there. He's the kind of lawyer you always want in every community whenever you want to tackle the odds, take on a big company, push for social justice. And he has a message for you. He's been volunteering for us for months. He has a message for you. And I hope you'll please stay and listen to it. And also, I'll be back so we can have a discussion. Greg Cufuri.